Welcome into This Has to Work. I'm Matt Hoddle, and today I'm joined by Matt J. Matt is a technologist, a founder, mentor, advisor, and an investor. He started his career in tech as a computer technician, ended up co-founding Procter U in 2008, and after a successful exit, now serves on multiple boards and advisory councils and is the current managing director of the Techstars Energy Accelerator in Birmingham, Alabama. How much of that did I get wrong?
You nailed it, Matt. So thanks for having me. This is awesome. I love being able to, you know, talk to community and share a story. Anything that I've learned, any mistakes that I've made, anything that I can do better, I'm all about giving back right now.
You've got such an interesting background. I mean, you have the real chops of actually doing the engineering work, actually doing, you know, the technical work, all the way up to leading whole teams and now leading an accelerator program here. So let's get into it. So in 60 seconds or less, give us kind of a rundown of your journey through your professional career and how you ended up here.
Yeah, so started out, got my degree in computer science and engineering from University of Florida, so go Gators. That's my affiliation, my allegiance. But I'll be honest with you, I got that degree from my parents. My parents were like, hey, you're first generation American, like you got to get that piece of paper. We didn't have that, so you're going to get it. I was like, okay, all right, you know what? I'll get it. So as soon as I got my degree, I was like, all right, you know, I got a piece of paper. But all this time while I was at UF, I was playing in rock bands, doing music and all this stuff. And so as soon as I got that paper, I was like, boo, I'm gone. I'm like, I'm out. I'm going to Los Angeles. I'm taking my band. We were in I was in a pop rock band, kind of like Matchbox 20 meets Blink 182. And we were actually pretty successful. We were signed to an indie label, touring all around the South, doing all the stuff, acquiring fans and all this stuff. And we were like, all right, you know, we all graduated UF around the same time. Like, let's go out to LA. Let's try to make it big. So that was the first big business mistake that I ever made. You don't just leave all your fans and everything you've acquired over the time and just go out to LA. So found it really difficult to make it in the music industry. And in the same time, I was doing all kinds of startup things. I started and failed a bunch of these little startups with friends. And one in particular, though, with my buddy Jared, we founded called Procter U. And that's a company that basically we watch students take exams over the internet using webcams and microphones. And that one started to take off. And so we came to an inflection point. I was like, okay, I'm still in LA. Jared was here in Birmingham. And he was like, all right, what are we going to do? Like, I mean, I technically could move out to Los Angeles, or you could move here in Birmingham and our runway could be a lot longer. And so
was it tough to leave LA?
It was tough to leave LA. So I have my wife and we were, we were pregnant. She was pregnant with our first child and we were just about to buy a house where we're putting offers in on homes. And so when this all happened, I was like, all right, you know what, Jared, we just put this offer in on a house. If that offer doesn't go through, I will somehow find a way to convince my wife to move from Los Angeles to Birmingham. And well, long story short, the offer didn't go through and she was devastated. So I popped up in laptop, found the home that she liked with the kitchen and the yard and all that good stuff, spun it around, showed it to her. And she was like, oh my God, that house is awesome. Oh my God, that price is amazing. Where is Birmingham, Alabama. I was like, yeah, well, hold on. Let me just explain this, all right? Like, so it took some convincing, but, you know, at the end of it, we packed up everything, moved across the country, two cats, a dog, came to Birmingham with the expectation now saying, all right, startups fail. We might be selling this thing in 6 months and doing something else. She's like, okay, you know, we'll trust you, we'll do it.
And let's set the stage. That's in 2008. Everything's about to fall apart in the mortgage like world and the market.
Well, this is right around 2010. So we've been doing some Procter U stuff since 2008. So we're building prototypes, like piloting with schools. And right around this point, 2010, is where it was clear that there was some traction to this thing. Like it was growing like crazy. So that's why I was like, all right.
Was there one specific thing that happened? Like you were sitting there and maybe it was a customer contract. Maybe it was, a product release or something like that. When it kind of clicked and you're like, all right, we're rolling here. This is going to be big.
Yeah, it was. So as soon as we put together the proof of concept, this MVP version in one school that we were working with. And the feedback we were getting was incredible. The school absolutely loved it. And just like all what academics do is they love to talk about the things that's going well for whatever they're doing, right? And so what they did is there was a panel. It was actually a keynote on distance education and learning. And Jared was on that keynote. And at the end of that keynote, he's talking about what he was doing, what we were doing, and all these institutions was like, hey, could you do this for us? And we knocked those pilots out of the park.
Was that surprising to you, or you're like, no, that's just confirmation of what we thought would happen?
It was a total surprise, because what Jared and I were actually working on was yet another type of social network to help students like study, come together. And then the ProctorU thing was actually a feature of the product that we were creating.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we pivoted, we just killed the social network. It was called People City, and we spun that thing out, that one piece of the functionality out, and that was what we decided to go with.
And at that point, you really, I mean, the whole company started scaling really quickly. And I think it's, so many people can be involved in startups and actually never be in an environment that's a fast-growing, fast-scaling company. And I think that there's a lot of perception about what that's like. My question to you is, what's the most common misconception about being in a fast-growing company?
I think one of the misconceptions that I commonly see, just from folks who haven't been there yet, is that everything is like smooth sailing and there's like, it's just gravy. It's just like, oh my gosh, all this good stuff is happening. All this cool stuff is happening. It's not like what I'm dealing with now, because I feel like crap. Like, and sometimes in one hour, one phone call, I can feel incredible. And then the next phone call, I'm like, oh God, like I don't want to do this anymore. It's still like that, but it's at a bigger, faster, crazier scale.
The stakes are higher,
the stakes,
right?
Are higher.
Because now it's not like you and a co-founder and maybe a, you know, some contract employees. Like, you got literally people's whole lives involved in this company now. It's like, this is how they make money. This is how they support their families, themselves, whatever the case may be. So that roller coaster, intraday roller coaster that all founders go through now has even bigger stakes.
Exactly right. And so I really saw that as an eye opener when I started to help startups and founders and so forth. They're like, oh, we got funded. We're at the top of the mountain. This is awesome. You're at the top of one of the mountains. And it might be probably one of the smaller mountains, you know?
What, for you as an individual, what skills did you have to acquire and become good at within that environment that maybe you didn't have before and you had to learn?
No, it was absolutely across the board. I was lucky that I had a solid foundational background in from a Fortune 500 Best Buy, and all the SOPs and everything and all the leadership training and all that stuff, operational knowledge, like all of that structure, I was able to just absorb and go, all right, creating this company from scratch, I don't need all of these things right now, but I'm going to need bits and pieces of them. And so that is what I really leaned on in order to be able to start from zero and bring the company along. And did I have to learn? I had to learn everything. I mean, I truly did. So that's why, I mean, I commonly say I've probably made every mistake that you could possibly imagine, lived to tell the tale and still be here. And hopefully I can share some of those mistakes with you and you can learn from them. You can either choose to go down that path. Hey, I'll support you. You want to go make that mistake and get that experience? Go ahead, go right ahead. But I have a pretty good idea where that's leading.
So to that end, you do a lot of mentorship, and you do mentorship with founders, but you also do mentorship just in general communities, ecosystems, things like that. So if somebody comes to you and says, hey, there's this, you know, fill in the blank startup, you know, they're a fast growing startup. They know it's a fast growing startup. They say, I'm thinking about joining that team. I'm not a founder, but I'm going to join that team. What piece of advice would you give them walking into that environment?
I think they really have to know what they're getting into first and foremost. So do a lot of that background work, discovery, see what stage of the business actually is in. Because I'll tell you what, there's companies that I work with, they look like they've got everything going on like perfectly on the outside. And then you kind of dig in, you're like, oh, okay, all right. You've got adult legs and adult arms and like a baby body, you know?
So you talked about the early kind of musical career and then effectively abandoning your fan base. That's an interesting choice, but I'm sure one now you look back on it says it was probably right. But then you go into this huge high growth startup. You had a very successful exit there, and you really had and still do, I assume, kind of the financial latitude, professional latitude to basically do whatever you want, or frankly speaking, nothing at all. So why jump back in something as high profile and intense as being a managing director at Techstars?
Man, I'll tell you what. When I exited ProctorU, and you're right, like set for generations, for life, forever, I wanted to give back. One of the things that I realized, though, before saying I want to give back, I realized that during that time with ProctorU over the course of a decade, one of the things that I regret is that I didn't spend as much time with my family as I probably should have. I prioritized, at first it was 100% business, then it was family and health and then everything else. But even then, when I realized, like, there was a point early in the ProctorU journey, when we first started, where I let go of the health and I was just like, I was 100+ pounds heavier than I am now.
Wow.
And I just was like, so stressed out and just everything. And I was like, all right, you know what? I can't do anything if I'm not healthy. So I put health first, business, and then family, and then everything else. And then, it ran like that until the exit. And so now, I mean, I still prioritize health, but it's health, family, then everything else. And so in that particular case, I found that, yeah, I'd love to jump into another startup, some other kind of whatever. But I realized too that during my journey, I really didn't give back either. I was so focused on executing and operating and just whatever. And I'm sure there were so many people that helped us along the way. I didn't do a good job acknowledging those people. I didn't really give back. And I really want to do that now. So now my focus is, you know, health, family, and in the business kind of side of life, let's give back.
Yeah. And man, you really overcorrected, right? From that standpoint, because you go into Techstars and one of Techstars' mottos is give first,
right?
So you kind of, you're making amends at like light speed pace comparatively to where you were. Techstars Energy Accelerator here in Birmingham is one of a kind. There is no other energy accelerator in the Techstars universe. And everything that I have seen and witnessed and come in contact with the program really does denote that it is a special program. But from your perspective, what makes that Techstars program so special?
This is going to sound like BS probably, but the special secret sauce of this particular program is the partner Alabama Power. And it is unique across all of Techstars. Like, their level of partnership and what they do is not the same as other partners in the Techstars ecosystem. There is no other partner that not only helps cover the cost of the program and all that stuff, but dedicates personnel full time to the program, opens the doors for, you know, the pilot opportunities, meeting staff, setting up the mentors, subject matter experts, coaches, all of this stuff. That is not common amongst the Techstars universe, I would say. And it is one of the things that makes this particular program super special and unique.
Yeah, it seems to me too. I mean, just hearing from the founders, it's palpable to them. I don't know if it's day one, but it feels kind of instantaneous. They get here, they start getting involved. And to your point about the Alabama Power partnership, the ecosystem in general, you know, you guys tend to launch those very well and kind of with big deal, and everybody comes out and supports it and all those things. So it does feel like they're kind of getting that experience pretty fast. To that end, a number of companies that have come through the program have elected to relocate their companies here. And I want to be really transparent about this. That is not in exchange for more investment. That is not in exchange for subsidies. That's not necessarily in exchange for anything other than they've been here intensely for 12 weeks, they've interacted with you, with Rhema, with everybody involved in the program, and they go, you know what, there's something here. What is it about that experience that goes, I'm going to pick up and basically do what you did, moving from LA to Birmingham? What is it about that experience that makes them want to do that?
It's nothing, I don't think, unique to the Techstars experience, honestly, and people are probably like, oh, you said that. No, it's the community. It's the people within the community. It's the Southern hospitality. the ability to network and communicate and just have these people that are willing to support you. I don't know if that's just a smaller, more regional experience. I mean, I came from LA prior to this, and if you wanted to meet a decision maker, it was like, all right, you got to talk to the assistant, to maybe the assistant, and then maybe you'd get a meeting with the actual decision maker. But here, it's like, hey, Matt, I want to talk to so-and-so person. Do you think you could intro me? Yeah, no problem. You know, that is unique. It seems to be unique to hear, and the businesses appreciate that, and they realize the traction and all the support that they get, and they decide to stay.
So you've spent time in a bunch of different ecosystems, obviously LA, here, other places. I know you're actually really involved in the city of Pelham and some of the development things that they're doing, which for anybody who's not from here, Pelham is almost due south of the city of Birmingham by 20 minutes, 15 minutes, something like that. But what is it about kind of the, for lack of a better term, the ecosystem here that has surprised you more than maybe you expected? And for you, it's kind of a unique question in this part, which is, here you are, Procter U, heads down, to your point earlier, just building, working, growing, trying to keep up, trying to get this thing where it needs to be. And then you kind of come back out of that. And really shortly thereafter, it feels like to me, from my perspective, you kind of leaned in. And during that process and up till now, what has really surprised you about the ecosystem that maybe you weren't expecting?
I wasn't expecting so much support and attention and focus on the tech and startup and entrepreneur ecosystem. I mean, I knew about Innovation Depot. I knew about the Velocity Accelerator. I knew, but I had no idea that all the other accelerators existed within the sphere. I didn't realize there were so many people, economic development agencies, all working to try to do similar things, to try to increase economic development through support of small businesses, startups, and so forth. So there's all this attention in this place. And what I love that I'm seeing now is that people are starting to work together. That was one of the big opportunities that I originally saw when I was like, all right, you've got all these people that want to paddle in the same direction, but they're all paddling in like different directions. And so the fact that we are now starting to do that is awesome.
It also feels a little bit like leadership around the ecosystem is from the same, for lack of a better term, graduating class, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you have folks like Nate, you have folks like Brooke, you have Miller, Gervin over at ADPA. I'm going to leave out a ton of people. Maria over at Birmingham Bound. But it's almost like this turnover of leadership. And that turnover of leadership is coming from a group of people that are really excited to work with each other and to benefit from each other in maybe a way that didn't exist before. Is that fair or is that an unfair
critique? No, I think that's fair. I think you called that out on our Coffees in Collision. And that was something that I think we all agreed upon, is that this flywheel effect, if you might say, is happening. Whereas, you know, you have these successful businesses, successful leaders, and they're staying within the community and they're taking the best of what they brought into those other companies and now spreading that amongst, you know, whatever they're doing now.
Yeah. And I found you to be a kind of a thoughtful guy from the standpoint of like, you really are thinking about, you know, kind of the ecosystem, the community, you know, your programming, the things that you're doing kind of holistically. And with that, there are going to be some critiques that need to come in there. So one thing I'm interested in your opinion on is, what kind of uncomfortable conversation have we not been having that we really should be having in our community?
Yeah, I think one of the first and foremost ones is that we have a big opportunity within the corporates, the large corporates that are within the community that don't participate in, you know, the ecosystem. Some may talk about it, but you know, when I was looking at some of the data, there are 16 like $1 billion companies within Birmingham, just Birmingham alone, and only one of those is actually participating in the ecosystem. So there's a pretty big opportunity.
Yeah, and I do think there's been participation, but it's kind of been intermittent, right? You know, people will participate and then they'll pull back, then they'll participate and pull back. But yeah, there's really kind of one organization that's been persistent, especially over the last 5 years. And I think that's uncomfortable. I think it's uncomfortable for anybody in that situation, but it's kind of the get comfortable being uncomfortable, to use the cliche, which I'm not a huge fan of, but fits in this situation. And so we need to kind of keep encouraging that.
We do. And that one corporate has, they've I think they're doing it the corporate way. They've created a guide that you can, it's almost like a book. It's great. But I don't really know what the reception of it has been. And we just need to keep on talking about it, invite those people out, and just hammer home that, hey, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff going here, and helping this area is going to help you guys also.
Yeah. So using the metaphor of this, you know, the startup kind of community being a little bit of a fire, what gasoline, for lack of a better term, should we really be throwing on that fire to make sure that it continues to grow and succeed?
You know, I've been thinking about what that, you know, that gasoline, that catalyst, whatever could really kickstart that scene. And the thing that comes to mind, unfortunately, is the availability of funds and mm-hmm. money in specific size business range. Now, you guys, like, I think you guys are leading the charge in this. So that's awesome. So they need to take the people that have the money need to be able to understand what the opportunity is. It's not only going to make you more wealthy in a lot of cases if you do it smart, but it's going to help the community in ways that you probably didn't imagine.
Yeah, part of what I've watched over the last 5 years is, and people may not like this term, but I think it's apropos, which is there's a sophistication that is now in our kind of startup mechanisms that really wasn't there before. And that's encouraging. And I think Techstars, for example, plays a huge part in that. I think the maturation of what Innovation Depot is doing plays a huge part of it. I think Prosperous Health Tech Accelerator, Bronze Valley's Accelerator, all of those things. One of the things I talk about all the time is people go, why do we need another accelerator? And I actually use Cincinnati as an example because they're kind of a corollary from population, you know, similar size, kind of post-industrial, for lack of a better term, but they have like 16 accelerator programs. We have like five, right? And the one right. thing that everybody will tell you is, A, what you're doing at Techstars is very different than what Bronze Valley is focused on, which is very different than what Prosperous Health Tech Accelerator is focused on, which is very different than, you know, insert other program. So I think that density is good. Seems like we could actually use some more of those.
No, I agree. I think what we're seeing in this community, and people are talking about, I heard it at Sloss Tech, is to create a healthy ecosystem, you have to create, you know, a lot of, I guess, momentum in all different stages of the business. So you have the early stage ideation folks, pre-seed, seed, Series A, Series B exits, and they stay and they fuel, you know, all the early stage growth, and it just becomes this sustainable, you know, thing.
Yeah, and it's not like that model hasn't been proven out. You know, I mean, and I'm not even just talking about San Francisco or New York or Boston. I mean, I'm talking about Austin, Texas. I'm right. talking about Boulder, Colorado. I'm talking about some of these places where that's exactly what happened. There were two or three companies did very well. People took their, you know, chips off the table and their exit and their liquidity, and they plowed it back in. Whether it's an angel investor, they started another company. We're seeing it here, right? Yep. I mean, we've seen the founders have shipped, have gone right back in and launched something else. The, you know, Hospice Link, you know, Shagan, Otolana, yep. Therapy Brands launches Harmony Venture Labs, which I'm very excited about, and they immediately plow it back in. That's how this kind of organic growth happens
right.
and is not reliant on anything outside of the ecosystem. It's kind of self-supporting. So let's take a global view. I know you're a technologist. I know you love technology. I know you love that whole, you know, kind of section of innovation. But when you take a pull back, everybody's talking about AI, I get that. Everybody's talking about, you know, large language models and machine learning and all those things. Okay. But when you take a big kind of, you know, step back, what should we all collectively be excited about around technology and innovation, kind of on a more global vision?
Global vision. And you just took the AI, machine, all that stuff out of the
You can double down
Man,
on AI.
I swear, I'm super excited and stoked about what we're doing in artificial intelligence and large language models. One of the kind of key performance indicators that I've been seeing around this is, since I'm in the Innovation Depot, I have the ability to see some of the events that happen. And one event, this AI meetup group that started with a couple community folks, and it was like maybe when the meeting first started, it was like maybe 10 people. It was hard to fill even the small Innovation Depot training room. And now this thing is like 200 some people once a month come out to hear about this. And then when I talk to the people that are, you know, attending these things, it's like, I don't really know much about AI, but I want to learn more. And they bring their friends, and now they've got all these ideas of what they can do with it and all this stuff. AI will, I mean, it is, and people that are non-technical are getting into this, and they realize that they can create these programs that do all these things using large language models, just talking to it like, oh, well, I want to create a form that parses through this, the data, and then it does this thing, right? And before, you would have to know how to do that from a programmatic perspective, but now you can just talk to the large language model just like I just described and output something that works. And if you don't like it, you'd be like, I don't like that. It should do this, and it'll correct itself.
The other part about AI that's interesting is that not all things called AI are AI. And so you get this really interested textured debate among the experts. Sure. What is AI? What's not? What's an algorithm? What's machine learning? Right? And kind of how those things work. So I do find that interesting. All right. So I don't want to say you're a music geek, but I'm a music geek. I assume you're a music geek.
Yep.
I'm going to ask you this one last question. It has absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about, but because I have another music geek on the podcast, I'm going to shoot my shot here.
Why not?
So popular albums all have those kind of two or three songs that get heavy rotation on a streaming service, or if you're my age, radio. What's your favorite B-side cut from a popular album?
Man, I don't know if it's popular, but I listened to the Andre 3000, like the latest release. I probably listened to it all the way through.
Maybe Dion Gordon, if you're listening right now, here's your guy.
Three times. Just because it's unique, it's interesting from a musical perspective. And it made me think, I was like, and you know what? I couldn't even name the track. You should go, have you checked that out yet?
I have not.
You should try just to read the names of the tracks. It's just like, it's like a sentence of the name of the track, and probably not appropriate for the podcast. But on that note, the tracks are fascinating. And what got me thinking about it, what keeps me thinking about it, is that it's it really highlights and showcases like the diverse talent of Andre 3000 and what he's capable of doing. But it also makes me think too that within the music, there's a lot of movement to it. There's a lot of dynamics, and so I caught myself re-listening to a lot of the pieces because I think that it was probably originally created as a score for something.
Okay.
And then it was like, all right, maybe that film wasn't used or was never released, so let's take all this music and release it as an album.
Matt J, appreciate you being here. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.